ability to protect them. They felt that they could enter into contracts and enforce their own contracts. With that, I'd like to move back to my second point regarding the issue that the petitioner says was tried by consent. He says that the constructive eviction argument was tried by consent, although there was no pleading of it. There was no pleading of it until 4 weeks after trial, after we had presented our motion for an instructive verdict, arguing to the court that it had not been pled, had not been presented, therefore we were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. At that point, the petitioner began to scratch his head a little bit and say, now wait, we ought to protect ourselves just in case this is heard in the court of appeals. So what we'll do is come back after the trial, 4 weeks as a matter of fact, we'll present our motion for a trial amendment to add the defense of constructive eviction and then ask the court to find it as a matter of law. Then we're covered. The petitioner cannot show you any place in the record where the issue of constructive eviction was tried during the trial of this case. It didn't exist. I was there. We can show you in two ways that it did not exist. Number one, as I've already mentioned to you, we filed a motion for instructive verdict based on the issue that it had saying, or acknowledging our argument, that this issue had not been tried by consent, or that it had not been tried at all, and therefore that we were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. That motion is in the record, and there's a hearing on that motion that was transcribed and is also before this court. Secondly, if it was tried by consent, why did the petitioner come back 4 weeks after trial and have the trial court find it as a matter of law? He says, no, wait, we submitted it with our issue of material breach. That under a broad submission rule, which was an appealing argument for Chief Justice of the 14th Court of Appeals, under the broad submission rule, we should be allowed to slip in constructive eviction under the issue of material breach and nobody will know the difference. And as a matter of fact, in their brief, they say, we didn't call it constructive eviction, we called it material breach. And all of the cases, including the case cited by the Chief Justice of the 14th Court of Appeals and the cases cited by the appellant, or the petitioner, the elements of constructive eviction are as follows. An intention on the part of the landlord that the tenant shall no longer endure the premises. Number two, a material act by the landlord that those acting or those acting under him that substantially interferes with the use and enjoyment of the premises. Number three, this act must permanently deprive a tenant of the use and enjoyment of the premises. And four, the tenant must abandon the premises within a reasonable time after the commission of the act. That's not anywhere close to being identical to the elements of material breach. A material breach of a contract has always been a party did not perform their obligations. Period. That's the end of it. It's a little bit like saying, okay, we're going to submit the issue of duress as the issue of failure of consideration. They're not the same issues. They're not the same concepts. They're not intended to be the same concepts. They cite the case of Bell versus Meeks for the proposition that these issues were tried together. In Bell versus Meeks, they ostensibly failed to tell you or remind us that the parties there agreed that the issue being presented was tried by consent. We don't agree to that. It was not tried by consent. Their arguments are creative. But if they are sustained, it could lead to very frightening results. If, for instance, a party were to plead total failure of consideration, and then later on try to come back and say what we meant to say was duress, and an appellate court were to seize on an opinion in this case and find out that, sure, that's okay under a broad submission rule, then you could have all kinds of things going on that would be against the policy that this court has affirmed time and time again. Under my second point, I would also like to talk about our allegation in the Court of Appeals that the trial judge abused his discretion in allowing the trial amendment. I don't like talking about abuse of discretion. It makes me uncomfortable. But I believe that in this case, it was highly warranted. In the transcript of the hearing on this trial amendment that is presented to the court and in your record, the judge stated that he acknowledged that the issue of constructive eviction was not before the trial court at the time of the trial, except that there was some evidence that he felt led to material breach of a lease. And then the trial judge said, and I quote, "It follows as nigh as today, as Shakespeare said," unquote, "that there was a constructive eviction, and I'm going to find it as a matter of law." This is 4 weeks after the trial. We did not have an opportunity to have a special issue submitted to the jury, not even an instruction on constructive eviction. It just was an unfair situation, and our hands were tied. The Court of Appeals agreed with us that we had not had a fair opportunity to defend ourselves. With that, I'd like to move on to my last point. This is something that the petitioner did not raise, but I think I would like to raise it here. He is not entitled to his damages that he's requesting in his application for writ of error. As I've demonstrated in his answer, and as is part of the record before this court, the only pleading which he cites in favor of or to support his claim for damages is a statement he made in his answer which reads, "Plaintiff's suit has been brought in bad faith and or for purposes of harassment and is therefore subject to penalties and obligations as the law dictates." He says that is our counterclaim. That will support an affirmative cause of damages against the Inwood North Professional Group. I cannot help but recall when I first found out that they were asking for damages. We were standing in the trial judge's chambers, over his desk, looking at a copy of the property code. Brock looks at me and he says, "You know, we're asking for damages against your client." And I don't need to tell you what I said to him, but I will tell you that whenever the issue was raised, either in special issues or in the trial testimony, or when he finally asked for an oral trial amendment on it, we objected strenuously.
Would you read again the language that was in the...
Yes, Your Honor. "Plaintiff's suit has been brought in bad faith and or for purposes of harassment and therefore is subject to such penalties and obligations as the law dictates."
Was that... what? Where did that appear in the petition? Was it the last thing? Or did it...
it was his last paragraph before his prayer in his answer. It was... there was never any demand for damages. There was never any discovery on damages. It was never brought up. And the only testimony they had on damages was Dr. David Ott's testimony that he should be entitled to recover his lost time in the litigation. And those were the damages that the jury found. I have found no case in the state of Texas which has allowed a litigant to recover his lost time out of his office because he's involved in a lawsuit. And that is our argument there. I think I have omitted a discussion of the express warranty, and I'd like to touch on it for a second. There was no express warranty in this situation. Petitioner's attorney this morning has stated that they should be allowed to defend against the independent covenant to pay rent because there was an express warranty. There is not a scintilla of evidence that there was an express warranty in this case. And they haven't been able to show any. There was no pleading, there was no special issue, there was no evidence on the issue of express warranty. And I would also submit, although we found no cases on point, that express warranty defenses are quasi-contractual and therefore are not, will not defeat an independent covenant to pay rent. If there is some other remedy available to a tenant other than damages, injunction, other kinds of contractual relief, I've never heard of it and I've never studied it. But there is adequate relief for a tenant in any situation where he feels like he has been wrong. And that's what our courts are for. There are two questions I'd like for the petitioner to answer. Why did he ask for a trial amendment and ask the court to find as a matter of law that there had been a constructive eviction if he now argues that it had already been found by the jury? under the issue of material breach, unless it was not tried by consent, as he now says it was. My second question for him would be, why didn't he file a proper counterclaim? Why didn't he do any discovery on damages? Why didn't he send us a demand letter at least and ask for damages? Why did he wait until the middle of trial to even talk about it? The Court of Appeals agreed that there had been an injustice done to the Inwood Moore Professional Group based upon the failures of the petitioner to do what he should have done during the trial of this cause. We ask that the Court affirm the opinion of the Court of Appeals. Your Honor, I have no further argument, but I'll be glad to answer any questions that exist.
Thank you, Counsel.
I will be happy to answer the two questions posed by the respondent, but before I answer those two questions, I have three questions that we have asked repeatedly in all of our briefing that have never been answered by the respondent. Why did the respondent not specially accept to the pleadings? Why did the respondent not object to the evidence when it came into the trial court? And why did the respondent wait until after the jury reached its verdict to complain that the special issues raised legal theories that were not allowable under Texas law? The reason Rule 274 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure requires that a party distinctly object to special issues that are presented to the jury, before the jury answers those issues, is so that we don't waste our time. So that if there is something legally wrong with an issue, if material breach is not an adequate defensive theory, if express warranty is not an adequate defensive theory, then the trial court has an opportunity to correct those issues and present the correct issues to the jury. Why did respondent not object to those issues? Well, those questions have never been answered in any of the briefing presented by respondent. The two questions raised at the end of his argument, to the contrary, have been answered in our briefing. His first question is, why, and if I understand the question correctly, why are we arguing on appeal that constructive eviction was tried by consent and not before the trial court? Well, the fact of the matter is that we did make that argument at the trial court, and we argued in the alternative. We asked for a trial amendment to support our pleadings in that he has waived any argument by failing to specially accept and to object to a broad submission of that issue. And secondly, why did we not give him notice of claims of damages? Well, I think, and the pleading speaks for itself, but the pleading specifically asked for affirmative relief, says that the suit has been brought in bad faith and for purpose of harassment, and therefore is subject to such penalties and obligations as the law dictates. Admittedly, a very general plea. Very general. Does not specify the amount of damages asked. But then again, there are no special exceptions.
Are you saying that's a viable pleading in the absence of special exceptions?
I am, Your Honor. And I think that that is the dictates of the precedent that is listed under Rule 90 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure.
Let me pose this to you. If you're asking for damages and you're the defendant, do you think it's incumbent upon you to file a counterclaim?
It depends upon the nature of the counterclaim. I think that we can plead for it alternatively in our petition, and I think we did so in our answer. And I think that our answer is sufficient in this case. I think it is particularly allowable when, as has already been pointed out, there are no special exceptions. To return, not that I disparage our claim for affirmative relief in the trial court, but I think that what is most important to Dr. David Dow is that the trial court judgment that the landlord not recover be affirmed. Let's begin with implied warranty of habitability. Now, I listened carefully to respondent's argument to see if I could hear his public policy reasons for not allowing such an implied warranty. The reason I listened for his public policy reasons is because I didn't give any public policy reasons for not recognizing the implied warranty in his brief. As far as I could discern, he had two public policy arguments for not to recognize an implied warranty of habitability. The first reason that I got was that Dr. David Dow was a bright guy and therefore he knew what he was doing. My response to that is simple. I don't think that the law should make a distinction with regard to an implied warranty or any other warranty based upon the intelligence of the plaintiff or the defendant. I don't think that's an appropriate distinction under the law. The second argument that he made, or seemed to make, was that too many tenants are getting out of leases now. Now, I don't know what the statistics on that are, but I can imagine Uriah Heep, 100 years ago, when described by Charles Dickens in his works discussing the inequities and injustices used by the landlord with respect to the tenants, using the same argument. Well, these tenants, they're always getting out of their leases. We need to be hard on the tenants. We need to be mean to the tenants. And I don't think that the law has recognized that kind of argument for about 100 years. And I might add that in 1926, when the El Paso Court of Appeals recognized in Mitchell versus Wise that there were in fact independent covenants, but only if the tenant continued to remain in possession. To rule otherwise would be to reach an equitable result and indeed return to the dark ages of 19th century law. Finally, I'd like to address very quickly, if I might, the material breach issue, the constructive eviction issue, and the express warranty. To begin with, the express warranty. He says there is no express warranty. Well, I think the record speaks for itself. Dr. David Dow testified at the time of trial that the lease space is represented to him by the landlord as appropriate for medical offices. I think that the lease itself, which is set out in Exhibit A to our brief, sets out specific requirements and specific promises in the lease.
Does the Pro 11 approval apply under the property code to any statements that the landlord might have made?
I honestly don't know, Your Honor. I do know this, that that argument was not raised in the trial court and is subsequently waived. Whether or not the parole evidence rule does in fact apply might have been an interesting point, but even if the parole evidence applied, it is our contention that the written lease standing alone constitutes an express warranty and that it was breached. So that's the express warranty issue. I think the jury answered that. I think the evidence is there. I think that issue is an independent argument in our favor. Constructive eviction. Island Recreation says a broad issue can contain more than one independent level of recovery. A special issue, as in Island Recreation, that simply asks where obligations performed under the contract can include an issue on waiver. I think a broad issue, asking on material breach of a lease, can include constructive eviction. And third, material breach, I think we've already disposed of that issue both in our argument and in our brief. To allow the landlord to materially breach his lease with impunity simply isn't just, it simply isn't equitable.
Doesn't the property code, at least on residential tenants, have a provision about withholding rent pending repair?
I think that Your Honor is quite correct, there is provision in the property code that prohibits tenants from withholding rent.
Oh, it prohibits? Is that what it is?
Yes. Okay. But of course, that property code provision contemplates the tenant continuing to remain in possession. Now, Dr. David Dale paid all the rent up until the time that he left these premises. So we're not talking about rent that was due for the time period that he was in this office. We're talking about rent that the landlord insists that he gets after the premises are abandoned because of a material breach. In conclusion, I would just simply like to touch on the facts of the case, which is where respondent began his argument. He says that of 1,340 days, that there were only 5 days, the doctor was absolutely unable to use his office. And he claims that we embellished the facts in this case. I think the record speaks for itself. But I point out that for 1,340 days, the air conditioning was not proper, that Dr. David Al was forced during the summer to sweat on his patients. I point out that for 1,340 days, that there was rotting carpet and mildew in this office space. I point out that for 1,340 days, that every time it rained, the roof leaked. I point out that for 1,340 days, that Dr. David Dow's office, which is, after all, supposed to be a doctor's office, clean and sanitary and capable of taking care of patients, was plagued with insects, rats, cockroaches, and other, as we say in our brief, indescribable pests. And that the parking lot, the hallway was littered with garbage, that the lighting in the hall was inappropriate, and that all of those problems existed for 1,340 days.
After that peroration, is there still some evidence that the tenant abandoned the premises within a reasonable time after the commission of the act?
I think that there is, Your Honor. First of all, when Dr. David Dow rented these premises, there were assurances that these problems could be fixed. Second of all, there was evidence in the record, and Mr. Akers discussed some of the facts involved in this lawsuit, that they were building another leased building, and that there was a falling out among his partners who were building this new building that led to some delay in time him leaving. And thirdly, I think that there is evidence in the record that he left when he was economically able to do so. And I think that all of that evidence supports the fact that he abandoned the premises within a reasonable period of time.
There's no submission on that. That's one of the things we would have to deem in support of the judgment.
Yes, but I don't believe that the court should have any problem with that under the explicit language with regard to deemed findings under Rule 279. In conclusion, we believe that there are multiple theories of defense that support the trial court judgment, and respondent, Dr. David Dow, respectfully prays that this honorable court find for Dr. David Dow, particularly in this case, on all issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the business of the court. The court will stand in recess.
Marshal. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.